This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. I'm grateful for your company on this Sunday afternoon. We are chock full of WMRA news from the past week, including a visit with Valley photographer and educator Howard Zaire as he returns to talk with prisoners serving life terms. That's a project he began 20 years ago. We also tour Lexington's new makerspace and a farm near Harrisonburg, where a crop of hemp is being grown and studied as Congress debates whether or not to legalize it. But first, the Charlottesville chapter of 100 Black Women will launch in October. Many local professional women have been pitching in to make that happen. And one of them is Shantron Franklin Sims, who has taken a leadership role in the fledgling organization. And she is the subject of the next installment of our Women of Interest series. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini has her profile.
Born and raised in Charlottesville, Shantron Franklin Sims is a mother of three, including two foster children, and is an office associate for Albemarle County Public Schools.
Thank you for calling Albemarle County Public Schools. This is Shantron. How can I help you?
She is also the organizing leader of the soon-to-be local chapter of the National Coalition of 100 Black Women. Their mission is to advocate on behalf of young black women to promote leadership development and gender equity in three main areas: health, education, and economic empowerment.
We want to be involved in our community as soon as possible, so we're building our mentor program.
She had learned about the already existing 100 Black Men of Central Virginia. Their mission is to eliminate the achievement gap of African-American males in grades K through 12 by pairing black students with successful local professionals. That way, children see the advantages of dedication in the classroom. While the two organizations have similar goals, they are not sister organizations.
Obviously, they support each other in cities where they both exist, but they're totally separate.
The local chapter of 100 Black Men here is led by Vice Mayor Wes Bellamy. About a year ago, Shantron and other women asked him why there wasn't an equivalent for black girls.
He took all the contacts and he gathered people's names and emails and literally sent out the email and said, for all the women who've ever told me that you want to see mentors for girls, let's get together at City Space downtown. Talk about it. So that's how it started.
Shantron became the first in her immediate family to go to college. To help her, she had other mentors.
Of course, there were teachers. I had this one trigonometry teacher, and she was a black woman, which was rare. It was like in the math field, it's usually white males. There was a member of my church named Miss Mason. When she saw you trying to help yourself, she would try to help you with little things. She would give me money. And Miss Morrison, she's also a woman that was an influence on me. You work hard, you can call the shots and decide what your life is going to be.
Of course, her mother was a big influence too.
She might not have known anything about how to apply for financial aid and what I should expect my freshman year and those kinds of things, but she did understand ethics and values and working hard and being responsible.
After graduating from Charlottesville High School in 1997, she went to George Mason University and earned a bachelor's degree in business management. She also became the first in her family to move far from home by starting her first real job in New York City, where she was an advertising sales assistant in various companies, including Newsweek magazine and Lifetime Television. She also experienced 9/11 up close and lost one of her brothers to murder here in Charlottesville.
My brother, he was a great guy, but unfortunately he had a lot of demons and he dealt with them with drug use. The briefest way I can put it is that he angered a really bad group of people. There was a conflict and they decided to resolve it by shooting him. And sadly, his killer was 19 years old at the time and he has life in prison with no chance of parole. Really, two men were lost.
After these life-altering events and 5 years in the Big Apple, she decided to come home in 2006.
When I left, I never thought I would come back to Charlottesville. So I came back home to my mom's detriment. She was very afraid of that because of her experience growing up here, which was like in a total different time. But I was seeing Charlottesville totally different at that point. My mom's neighborhood, she's lived there, I think it's going on 27 years. And it's a predominantly African-American neighborhood and has been for decades. And now you go in my neighborhood and there's all different ethnicities. And it's really interesting because my mom thought, well, we never thought people from other ethnicities would be comfortable coming here. And someone who went through segregation, for her, it's very different. You know what I mean? So I think Charlottesville has come a long way and changed a lot. I do think that there's a lot that still needs to change, but that's not our whole story.
Shantron wishes to contribute to this change, and now she might very well become the first president of 100 Black Women's local chapter.
I hate to assume, but it's assumed by myself and others that I likely will be the first president of this chapter.
It is not something she had planned for herself, though.
No one really wanted to like jump in. I was like, what are we going to do? Let's set some goals, and so you're leader at that point. To be honest, it's quite intimidating. I'm surrounded by a really dynamic group of women from all different professions. I'm an office assistant. I'm surrounded by like CEOs and principals.
The 100 Black Women of the Charlottesville metropolitan area will be chartered on October 14.
And we're getting ready to send out invitations. I will also mention that, you know, we've had people approach us and say, well, can I be a member? I'm a white woman. And we're like, of course you can. If you're interested in the work that we're doing, I mean, we want to impact our community, period.
They have a Facebook page. And you can also reach the birthing organization at civilmentors@gmail.com. For WMRA News, I am Marguerite Gallerini.
Support for WMRA's Women of Interest series comes from F&M Bank, a local independent community bank since 1908 with locations throughout the Shenandoah Valley. Online at fmbankva.com.
The Sentencing Project reports that nearly one in every seven people in prison is serving what effectively amounts to a life sentence. 20 years ago, a book of photos and interviews of nearly 60 lifers in Pennsylvania prisons provided rare insight into their lives and thoughts. This year, the author of that book, who now lives in Rockingham County, is reconnecting with some of those same people. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz reports.
It's been a quarter of a century since Broadway resident Howard Zaire interviewed and photographed the subjects for what became his 1996 book, Doing Life, Reflections of Men and Women Serving Life Sentences. He's been revisiting about two dozen of these men and women in preparation for a follow-up, which he's calling Coping with Life. They've been joyous reunions, he said, but they've also made him very sad when he tries to imagine what it must be like. Zaire recorded his interviews.
How do you describe a life sentence today? You remember I asked you how you would describe it 25 years ago. How would you describe it today? Everybody I've ever asked says, whew, first.
Yeah, I don't know if I even have any reference to compare it to because I've been here so
been
long.
Been so long, yeah.
I mean, McDonald's wasn't even open for breakfast when I came to jail.
Marilyn Dobrolensky has been in prison since 1972 and has kept herself occupied painting with watercolors, welding, training dogs. She's in the process of filing for commutation.
So I'm trying not to get my hopes up to have them let down again because I don't know, at this age, that would go over very well.
How old are you?
I'll be 65 this
year. Yeah, I thought maybe, yeah.
Zaire is known as the grandfather of restorative justice, which considers the needs of victims in the justice process and focuses on repairing the harms of crime. He wanted his book, Doing Life, to offer an opportunity to see offenders as individuals with their own fears and dreams, rather than stereotypes. Zaire hopes that this sequel collection, Coping with Life, will show how people endure, find meaning in, and even transcend being in prison for life.
They're trying to restory their lives. They're trying to incorporate what happened into their lives. I've often talked about that with crime victims, but it's also true with people who commit crimes. And I saw that clearly in Harry Twiggs, for instance, trying to reconcile the terrible guy that he was, as he readily admits, with who he is now today. And you can't just say these are two different, absolutely different people. And the way it's often done is by saying that prepared me and gave me the insights that I can now use that made me who I am and I can now use to help others.
Here's Harry Twiggs, a lifer that Zaire said is using his past to help others.
One of the counselors told me, she said, your problem is not drugs and alcohol or crime. She said, your problem is you. You have a Harry Twiggs problem. I'm trying to make up. You know what I mean? For all the years and the pain and the suffering and stuff that I've caused people. When I was out there, I was in the way. Now I'm able to show people that's trying to find their way, I can show them.
Kimberly Joins is another person who tries to support others in facing adversity. She works as a certified peer specialist with younger women in prison.
What would you say today if you were describing a life sentence? How would you describe it?
Oh, boy. I've been thinking about this for a long, long time. The good thing about it is the joy I receive from helping myself and others. The bad part about it is the negativity. You have to fight with every fiber of your being to be constructive. It's just heart-wrenching to see so many people that really had to live pillar to post. I extend my compassion and my comfort in the best way I can to help them realize there is so much. Let me see a better way to phrase it. It's so much more joy than there is hardship. You just have to come to a point in your life where you believe goodness feels better than the pain you've endured.
Zare doesn't know yet whether this collection, Coping with Life, will end up as an exhibit or a book, but he is sure that if he were to be photographed in a prison setting, he'd look like a prisoner too. That's why in his photography, he uses a plain backdrop.
I want you to confront the person, what they look like, what their eyes are saying, what they're saying with their voice, and not have other things to make judgments with.
However it takes shape, Zare's result will be a glimpse inside, into the people who are living, likely for the rest of their lives, behind fences and locked gates, and, for those of us on the outside, maybe even into our own expectations of the criminal justice system. For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
A new community center in Lexington is welcoming all self-described hobbyists, tinkerers, and creators to come together and make. WMRA's Faith Pinu has this story on the Lexington Co-Laboratory and Makerspace.
Meet 27-year-old Victoria Fallen, a landscaper in Lexington who is spending her Thursday evening taking apart an old cell phone.
I didn't know that there were so many different little pieces.
Fallen showed up at the new Lexington Collaboratory and Makerspace without any idea for a project. But then she was handed a drill, a screwdriver, and a cell phone, and she's set to work. That's pretty much how the Makerspace works. Someone comes with an idea, someone else brings some energy, and with the help of a few tools, a project unfolds. It could be anything. Taking something apart, putting something together again, or creating something new altogether. Jamie Gooden, co-manager of the Makerspace and marketing strategist at Washington and Lee University, says he wants the facility to become the go-to spot for anyone with a product idea, an obscure skill, or even just a curiosity.
A lot of kind of the Makerspace mindset is just getting in there and build something. It really is like Legos for adults. Have fun, have your hands on something, build something, and watch it work.
If that sounds really general, Gooden says that's the right idea. The Makerspace is a place you can go to make anything.
I really want to take this lawnmower engine I have and attach it to my bike somehow. I just want to do it, and people will help you. That is the community, the culture we're really trying to build.
The Lexington Makerspace opened the first week in July with grant money from the nonprofit Main Street Lexington. Already, the walls are lined with materials, from cardboard and insulation foil to a sewing machine and a robot that can draw on any surface. Gooden says he hopes the Makerspace will one day house a tool library with enough materials to supply any project. So far, local community members have donated all the supplies. The tools are there to tinker with, inspire new ideas, and help people bring their pipe dreams into existence.
So we kind of envision a Makerspace where people can come and meet and just have a good community meeting center for education, which is cool in itself, but also have people network and be able to actually create products there or modify products there, like get custom engraving for branding, or meet the people who can help them do those things. There's a lot of people that know how to build a website, and there's a lot of people that know how to build a table, but not necessarily both.
Makerspaces are popping up all over the country, but the idea for one in Lexington took shape when city manager Noah Simon started his term 2.5 years ago. He had seen Makerspaces positively impact the economy where he used to live in Georgia, and he wanted to bring the opportunity for economic development to Lexington.
But it's just that intersection of ideas, and I want Lexington to be that crossroads of ideas, crossroad of innovation. We're looking at small, unique kinds of cottage industries that could really blossom in Lexington. So you could locate here, or you could already be here and want to do these kinds of things, and now you have another forum in which you can collaborate and innovate. And, you know, who knows, maybe that next $1 million or $1 billion idea will come as a result of our makerspace.
No $1 billion ideas have sprung up yet, but the makerspace has held several makers jams, those meetings where people like Victoria Fallon tinker and brainstorm new projects, as well as a workshop to teach how to make a hydraulic-powered machine. Makerspace members plan to regularly hold more workshops for specific inventions or professional development skills. And the subject of these makers meetings doesn't have to be something as tangible as making a machine. Someone could come in with an idea for a software program or a sewing project. Andy Martin, a Spanish teacher at Rockbridge County High School, says these specialties already exist in Lexington. It's just a matter of bringing people together to harness that creativity.
It's a weird little oasis in the middle of the Shenandoah, I feel. Just there's so much culture, there's so many ideas. It's a town of, incubation.
Gooden says that with enough tinkering and collaborating, big ideas are bound to ignite.
This whole thing is really a grand experiment in lofty ideas. It's the loftiest idea to think, okay, if we just have a space and we have a few tools and we have a few meetings, people are going to start making businesses. That sounds pretty crazy, but I'm glad that that's our goal.
For WMRA News, I'm Faith Pinu.
Finally today, growing and processing hemp is still against the law in the United States, but 6th District Representative Bob Goodlatte wants to see industrial hemp become a legal crop for farmers, and a JMU professor is developing that potential option. Christopher Clymer-Kurtz has that report.
After a while, you almost begin to wonder what industrial hemp can't be used for.
Rope, insulation,
automobile parts,
chipboard, particle board, animal bedding, hempcrete,
clothing,
creams, hand lotions, body lotions.
It can replace fish oil in your diet.
Nutraceuticals, biodiesel, pharmaceuticals, just about anything you can make out of plastic. Canvas sails, composite construction materials, flooring, ceiling, acoustic tiles, human food. Literally tens of thousands of uses for hemp.
But
it's not something that you can, you know, cut off the plant and then light it up and smoke it.
Representative Bob Goodlatte is one of 16 co-sponsors of a bill called the Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2017, introduced this summer to, quote, amend the Controlled Substances Act to exclude industrial hemp from the definition of marijuana and for other purposes. The bill has been referred to the Committee on Energy and Commerce and the Committee on the Judiciary, which Goodlatte chairs.
Consumers right now buy hundreds of millions of dollars worth of hemp products every year. But unfortunately, all of the hemp and the production of the product has to take place outside the United States. We want to change that with this law.
Because growing and processing hemp has been illegal for many years, there's a lot of catching up to do. Permitted research. On a Rockingham County farm, tucked deep inside a cornfield where a harvester and trucks were recently at work, is a 10-acre plot of hemp. One of 7 plots totaling between 40 and 50 acres that James Madison University biology professor Mike Renfro is using in his research.
What we really need is to find what cultivars are well suited to Virginia and then breed and start improvement programs among those cultivars and really produce Virginia-specific cultivars that are going to work best for our farmers here.
His partner in research here is farmer Glenn Rhodes.
This crop is 70 years or more behind other crops in research. So when you even look at yields on our crops, those are probably 1930 yields.
Hemp does have a history here in the valley. It was one of the crops that the first British colonies were required to grow for the crown.
Hemp is really what kept the British Navy afloat because they would use the fibers for making the canvas sails and also making the rope for the rigging. This part of Virginia right here in the Shenandoah Valley in the late 1600s, early 1700s, was the nation's largest hemp-producing region.
But by the 1970s, the hemp market had been shut down. Hemp is related to marijuana, just like Brussels sprouts is related to broccoli. They are different cultivars of the same species, Renfro said. The 1970 Controlled Substances Act outlaws the whole cannabis sativa species under Schedule 1, even though hemp plants are very different than marijuana. Hemp plants are tall and slender and must have THC levels below 0.3%, whereas marijuana growers want lots of leaf and flower material and much, much higher THC levels. Renfro says any concerns that marijuana growers might hide their crops in hemp fields or smuggle marijuana in hemp shipments are unfounded fears.
Between the difference in visibility and the bad breeding effects that would come along with it, I don't think that's a big concern.
Out at the hemp field, Rhodes picks a stalk to show its different parts.
I'm sure this doesn't translate well to radio, but this fiber is extremely tough. I mean, I just can't tear that. Now, you can get it down small enough where you can tear it, but it is extremely tough. This is a hemp heart. It's the inner part of the seed. That is a very nutritious product. You can buy it commercially now. It's just amazing that we can't grow it and sell it here.
Renfro says that hemp could be a replacement crop for former tobacco farmers, because farmers can get good yields off of even smaller farms, yields that Rhodes thinks could eventually be a really good cash crop. He says farmers are excited to join the market.
You hear all the jokes about, are you growing marijuana and all that, and then you get the farmer that walks up and says, when can I start growing it?
The work of bringing together farmers and processors to establish manufacturing streams for a crop that's still illegal isn't finished yet. But Representative Goodlatte is optimistic about the prospects of removing the legal barrier to making hemp a domestically produced commodity.
I think it's going to have very broad bipartisan support. It should pass the House easily. The United States Senate's another question, but again, I think it'll have bipartisan support there. Commercial production hopefully will occur in the near future, but you never know how long the legislative process is going to take.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to support our news coverage, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. All our stories are archived at that website. Be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. And don't forget to keep up each morning with the WMRA Daily. It's our new weekday early morning news podcast. Listen at WMRA.org. And to sign up for the podcast there or wherever fine podcasts are available. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I will talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.